You are listening to a recording from the Bellevance Honors Program Lecture Series at Salisbury University. My name is James Buss, and I am director of the Thomas E. Bellevance Honors Program, which was founded more than 30 years ago and has served thousands of area students who have taken honors courses and attended events like this lecture. The Honors Program views university environments as great incubators for creative, cultural, and intellectual energies across the Delmarva Peninsula. This lecture series invites speakers from across the United States to speak about topics that relate to regional, national, and global issues. All of the lectures are free and open to the public. Dr. C. Joseph Jenniton Palaua is a professor of history at Illinois College. He's an accomplished teacher, receiving accolades at both Illinois College and Michigan State University. And as you will soon discover from the laundry list of publications and awards that I'll read to you here shortly, a remarkably proficient scholar. Dr. Jenniton Palaua is the author of Crooked Paths to Allotment, which I believe I'm obligated to hold a copy before you. You can fight over it later. Crooked Paths to Allotment, The Fight Over Federal Indian Policy After the Civil War, which was published by University of North Carolina Press in 2012. I could tell you that it's a great book, but as LeVar Burton on Reading Rainbow has most eloquently said, you don't have to take my word for it. Historian Valerie Scherer Mathis wrote recently in the Journal of American History that Crooked Paths to Allotment was, quote, a welcome addition to the scholarship on indigenous history, and that it was both well-written and well-researched. Dr. Jenniton Palaua has also authored articles in both the Journal of Women's History and the Western Historical Quarterly. Next year, the State University of New York Press will publish a volume that he co-edited, titled Beyond Two Worlds, Critical Conversations on Language and Power in Native North America, for which he also penned a chapter. Other work will appear in yet another edited collection, sponsored by the George and Ann Richards Civil War Center at Penn State University, where Dr. Jenniton Palaua contributes a chapter that reconsiders Native American history in the Reconstruction era. And, as the list continues, in the upcoming weeks, the New York Times will post a piece by our speaker on their website as part of the blog Disunion, which commemorates the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. In preparation for his new book, the topic of tonight's lecture, Dr. Jenniton Palaua has been awarded fellowships at the United States Capitol Historical Society and the Office of the Architect of the Capitol. Most recently, he has been awarded two prestigious fellowships, the first by the John W. Kluge Center at the Library of Congress, and a second from the Smithsonian Institution. As far as my knowledge, and the recent government shutdown has prevented me from conducting further research on this matter, he is the only person to hold these two honors simultaneously. Let's hope that the shutdown ends so he can get back to work. It is my great privilege and honor to introduce a great teacher, a great scholar, and my friend. Please welcome Dr. C. Joseph Jenniton Palaua.
Well, thank you for that generous introduction. Thank you to Salisbury University, and especially the Thomas E. Bellevance Honors Program for inviting me here to the Eastern Shore today. I'm really happy to be here. I've been here for a few hours, and I already got a chance to sit in on a class and work with some really great honors students. I'd also like to thank Jim Buss, the honors director, for making me feel so welcome here. Before I get started, I think it's important to acknowledge the homelands of the people where we think and speak together today. We do so on Nanticoke and Wicomico lands. I was really pleased to see actually all of the names of the residence halls named after the local indigenous communities. I thought that was really great. So tonight, I want to talk a little bit about that first project that Professor Buss mentioned, Crooked Paths to Allotment, just as a way to introduce how I became interested in thinking about Native people in urban environments, Native people in Washington, D.C. in particular. So I'll talk briefly about that, but then I want to shift into talking about a series of stories. One story about a woman named Letta Myers Smart, an exceptional woman who lived in the middle of the 20th century, will kind of serve as the through line to this larger collection of stories that I want to tell tonight. So this first book, Crooked Paths to Allotment, was a study of politics, the study of politics of policymaking, that focused on a constellation of reformers and activists, both native and non-native, as well as white allies, who, at various points, put forward viable policy alternatives. These moments revealed the alternative possibilities that existed in the development of United States colonialism. There were moments when power came under question, when politics and policies were debated, and when uncontested progress was contested. Among the reformers, two stood out as especially interesting. One was a guy named Thomas Bland. He was a white Washington, D.C. newspaper editor. He was born in Indiana, trained as a physician, became a populist agitator in the 1800s. He led a very interesting life. But the other one was Ely S. Parker, a Tonawanda Seneca condoled chief who became the first Native commissioner of Indian Affairs in 1869, and that's his picture there in the middle. He led a very fascinating life. He was an interpreter for Seneca diplomats in Albany and Washington, D.C. He was a condoled chief. That meant he was raised to the position of one of the hereditary leadership roles in the Iroquois Confederacy. He was an engineer, a military bureaucrat, a policymaker, and a clerk. He lived and studied with other Iroquois people, Haudenosaunee people, in Ontario. He worked on the Erie Canal. He studied law in western New York. He oversaw the building of customs houses and other federal buildings in Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, and Virginia. He fought in the Civil War. He lived in Washington, D.C. at several different moments, and then later in New York City, working for the NYPD, spending time at the end of the 19th century with both Jacob Riis and Theodore Roosevelt. But it was Parker's experience in Washington in the 1840s, the 1850s, and the 1860s that became especially interesting for me. And while I couldn't really focus on that exact experience in the first project, that became kind of an avenue for me to think about Parker's experience and the experience of other Native people in Washington, D.C. It's a picture of a diary that I found that he wrote in 1847. That's the first page. It's dated January 1st, 1847. He talked about the New Year's Day celebrations in the Capitol. It's just a short diary. It's just an excerpt that we have. It's all that's left, about 16 pages maybe. But reading that diary and thinking about what that experience was like for a man who was 19 at the time, a young Native man in this emerging and evolving imperial capital city, imagining what that experience was like and hearing his own words through that diary really inspired me to look more at that story. Parker's experience advocating for his community in the Capitol became the entry point into a much deeper and longer set of stories that reaches back thousands of years and forward up to the present. And so those are the stories I'd like to share with you today. But keep that diary in mind, because I'm going to come back to it in a while. So this is a set of stories that are all related to one another. I'll jump across time, but they have similar themes. In 1958... the statue groups that stood on the cheek blocks of the Capitol building's east front were curiously removed. For over 100 years, Luigi Persico's The Discovery of America and Horatio Greenough's The Rescue bookended the staircase, greeting congressmen and visitors as they entered and left the building, and serving as fixtures at every presidential inauguration. And in the middle of the slide, you can see one of Lincoln's inaugurations there. Ledemeyer Smart, a member of the Omaha tribe of Nebraska, led the removal campaign from her position as assistant to the sachem of the California Indian Rights Association based out of Los Angeles. She wrote dozens of letters to legislators, art critics, and architects throughout the 1950s. She was tenacious, perceptive, and really witty. In one letter, for example, to the long-serving architect of the Capitol, David Lynn, she threatened, quote, to take a stick of dynamite, no, two sticks, and blow up the rescue group. Laugh. She actually wrote that in parentheses in her letter. It's kind of like the 1950s version of LOL, I think. But then, fearing that she might have just incriminated herself, suggested that perhaps she just have to, quote, go and get the communists to do the job. She continued, seriously now, Mr. Lynn, I've been as busy as one could be when they are as indisposed with arthritis as I've been for several weeks, writing and talking whenever I get the chance about those hideous statues that are a disgrace to the Indian race shameful things that never should have been put up in the first place. At other points, she referred to the statues as unflattering and unjust, and a great source of humiliation to every Indian who set foot in Washington. Throughout her campaign, she maintained that the images portrayed in these monuments were not only violent in their content, but their continued existence on the stairs of the Capitol building reenacted the violence of conquest and United States settlement on a daily basis. And in learning about Letta Myers Smart, who I've come to have a lot of respect for, not only was she writing about how she was dealing with crippling arthritis, but she also served a short prison sentence for bashing her son-in-law in the head with a phone because he didn't like how she was treating her daughter at one point. She was a really strong woman. In telling this story, which is part of this larger project examining the tensions between the lived experiences and the commemorative landscapes in Washington, D.C., I want to assert that Smart's campaign reflects in some really important ways the 1950s Cold War context and connects to some other examples of Native American activism in the 20th century, especially in the period between the creation of the National Congress of American Indians in the 1940s and the American Indian Movement in the 1960s and 70s. But perhaps more importantly, I want to argue that her efforts comprise just one episode in a temporally deeper, complex local history of Native people challenging symbolic displays of violence and conquest in the Capitol and claiming or reclaiming space within the evolving urban imperialistic city. Most people today think of Washington as a tourist destination, a place to experience history. Excite, engage, entertain, exclaims the DC Convention Bureau website, or perhaps in the most recent days, a place to be irritated at our legislators, I suppose, is another thought we have. But it was not always this way, nor was Washington always a seat of global power. It was a local place, first. It became national. It became global. Native experiences with the city shaped that process of becoming, and Letta Myers Smart's story provides us with a window in. Examining the art within and around the United States Capitol building highlights how central the portrayals and suggestions of indigenous violence were to the commemorative landscape in Washington. In addition to the statues on the east front, the works inside the Capitol Rotunda, sandstone reliefs of Pilgrims, Pocahontas, William Penn, and Daniel Boone, as well as large historic paintings depicting Pilgrims, again, Pocahontas again, De Soto, and Christopher Columbus, all contribute to a larger narrative of conquest and defeat. The art and architecture of the Congressional Hall was created in conjunction with and designed specifically to justify and legitimate America's sense of manifest destiny. In her book, Art and Empire, art historian Vivian Fried asserted that, and these are her words, the sculpture and painting of the U.S. Capitol outlines the course of North American empire by promoting and legitimizing the subjugation of Native Americans. These pieces of art, she suggested, present situations from the past that seem to condone the policies being contemporaneously formulated by Congress and the presidents, namely the removal and reservation policies of the early to mid-19th century. Luigi Persico, who was born in Naples and immigrated to the United States in 1818, sculpted the discovery of America out of Serravezza marble between 1840 and 1844. James Buchanan, a close friend of Persico's, said that the piece represented, quote, the great discoverer when he first bounded with ecstasy upon the shore, all his toils and perils past, presenting a hemisphere to the astonished world with the name America inscribed on it. The massive frame, frontal position, and rigid pose of Columbus is contrasted with the crouching and hesitant indigenous woman. Her twisted pose with uneven and broken contours differs significantly from his solid, massive form. Of course, it's worth noting that Senator Charles Sumner, a consistent critic of Capitol art, demanded, what is Columbus going to do? Roll a game of nine pins? Because it looks like he's going to bowl. A report filed by the Washington Art Union Association criticized this group as well, but it focused on the Native woman instead. It said that her, quote, crouching position destroys the effect of the whole and suggests a subject for ridicule rather than admiration. And I put a couple of different images up here of all different angles, including one from behind. And I did that for a reason, so keep that in mind too. Horatio Greenough, whose much maligned sculpture of George Washington was placed in the Capitol Rotunda in 1841, but later moved to the East Lawn, and now resides in the Smithsonian National Museum of American History in the basement, was commissioned to create the group on the opposite side of the staircase. And I put a picture of the Washington statue there. Maybe some of you have seen it in the basement of the American History Museum. He also chose Saravesa marble in consultation with Persico, and his group, The Rescue, took its position in 1853. Secretary of State John Forsyth said, "I know of no single fact in profane history that can balance the one so wisely chosen by Mr. Persico as the subject of Greenough's group, which shall commemorate the dangers and difficulty of peopling our continent." Ignoring, unironically, of course, the fact that the continent had already been peopled. The native woman in Persico's image has been replaced with a muscular Indian man who's struggling against a hulking settler's restrictive arm hold. This piece does not suggest assimilation, but rather subjugation. The same report that ridiculed Persico's statue suggested that while Greenough, quote, evidently intended to do something bold and strong, the very exaggeration of the design renders it weak and meaningless, while the execution is only commonplace. So when I was a fellow at the Capitol building, I was working in an office in the basement of the building, the curator's archive, where they keep any bit of historical documentation relating to the art and artwork of the Capitol. So as these pieces of art were installed in the 19th century, these art magazines published reviews and critiques and things like that. I read dozens and dozens of these. And about this particular statue, the initial critiques that were antagonistic, the ones that said negative things about this statue, focused on the dog at the bottom there. Focused on the dog's placement, on the dog's demeanor, on the dog's attitude, on the dog's facial expression, and on the accuracy of its imagined breed. Apparently it was supposed to be a Newfoundland, and there was some question about whether or not there were Newfoundlands in America in the 18th century. Little was said about the more dramatic and violent content in the statues. Despite the original poor reviews, however, both statue groups found general acceptance and even admiration on the east front stairs. In fact, in an issue of The Crayon, which is one of these 19th century magazines devoted to art criticism, the author W.J. Stone noted that The Rescue was, quote, refined, chaste, and beautiful. He also displayed an uncommon self-awareness about portrayals of violence and conquest in the art that had filled and surrounded the Capitol over the past two decades. This is what he said. "Although their lands were necessary to us, we should not hand down to posterity our deeds of oppression toward the Aborigines by having it sculpted in stone on the very walls of the rotunda." Then, after recounting a story in which an anonymous Indian man strolled through the Capitol Rotunda, openly criticizing and challenging the narratives told in the reliefs that native people were killed after giving food and land to settlers, he concluded that, quote, "This little incident has been mentioned to show how far superior Greenough's design for the rescue is. It can never be so severely criticized by our Aborigines." Perhaps he spoke too soon. I'm not really sure when Letta Meyer's smart first trained her eyes and her formidable pen on the statue groups. The earliest letter I found was written in 1952. She outlined her critiques most clearly in a letter to the National Sculpture Society in 1953 and expanded those ideas in an open letter titled The Last Rescue, published in Harper's in 1959. To the National Sculpture Society, she wrote, "The American Indian is no longer, if he ever was, the bloodthirsty savage Greenough made him out to be in this group of sculpture. We feel we ought to rescue the Indians," and she underlined rescue, "from these deplorable straits." In Harper's, she asserted that the, quote, "whole thing gives a very unflattering and unjust impression of the American Indian, who was better known for his acts of kindness to early settlers than for his savagery." Across the staircase, she noted that the unfortunate Indian woman stands there looking up at Columbus in awe or wonderment or possibly worry. And she concluded, after taking a look at the statue from the rear, that, quote, "it must be worry. She's about to lose what little clothing she wears." Her criticisms focused on the violence portrayed and implied by the statues. Physical violence, sexual violence, the violence of historical abstraction, of conquest, and of continued settler colonialism. There were a few earlier attempts to move or remove the statue groups. A Congressional Joint Committee on the Library, which was the committee responsible for decisions related to the art and architecture of the Capitol complex, discussed in 1850 moving the discovery away from the stairs. But the reasoning behind their discussion was never clear. It might have been because Greenough's corresponding statue group was delayed. It wouldn't be placed until 1853, so it kind of looked uneven with one statue on one side but nothing on the other. In 1939, a representative from Rhode Island, Clark Burdick, introduced a joint resolution in the House of Representatives to have the rescue, quote, "removed, ground into dust, and scattered to the four winds, that no more remembrance may be perpetuated of our barbaric past," referencing the violent actions of conquest perpetrated by settlers, not the portrayal of potential violence against a settler family imagined in the statue. The monument, his resolution stated, was a, quote, "constant reminder of ill will toward the American Indian." In 1941, another representative, James O'Connor from Montana, who also chaired the Committee on Indian Affairs, echoed Burdick's sentiments in his own resolution. He asserted that the rescue, quote, "misrepresented and grossly maligned Native people, and that the group is an atrocious distortion of the facts of American history and a gratuitous insult." He concluded his appeal arguing that it, quote, "perpetuates a slander, tends to promote disunity, and falsifies American history." Both resolutions died in committee without coming up for a vote. Several different organizations and individuals backed Letta Meyer-Smart in her campaign. The National Congress of American Indians, the California Indian Rights Association, the Southern California Office of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, as well as members of the Oklahoma State Supreme Court, all wrote letters and passed resolutions in support. Although there were several other factors that contributed, including a project to expand the east front of the Capitol building, Smart's effort played the decisive role. In a letter to George Stewart, who had replaced David Lynn as the architect of the Capitol on the subject of what should happen to these statues, a Republican congressman from Michigan, August Johansson, wrote, "Maybe it's a good time to make peace with the Indians." Discovery and rescue were taken off the cheek blocks and currently reside in a remote Smithsonian storage facility at Fort Meade. So here you can see the Columbus statue. The arm is broken off. The kind of marble that they used was a very soft marble, and it wasn't actually fitted well to the climate and environment of the Chesapeake and Potomac. The humidity and the cold in the winter and other things causes a process called sugaring, where it kind of gets like particularized and starts to fall apart. So smaller pieces like the woman's fingers start to fall off and things like that. Here's the other one, the rescue. The crane actually dropped the rescue and smashed it into a lot of pieces. There's the head of the guy here. When I opened up this folder of pictures, that one kind of like jumped out at me, like here's this decapitated head. But just above that is probably my favorite picture from this folder. Of all the pieces of the two statues, the dog has fared the best. It was rescued from the rubble and became part of a collaborative exhibit put on by the Middlebury College Museum of Art and the Office of the Architect of the Capitol in 1999. In fact, of all of the pieces of these statue groups, it's the only bit that it remains in a museum today fully restored. So much for all those critics. While there are many different ways to interpret Smart's campaign, it makes sense to situate it within the context of Native activism during the Cold War. Recently, several scholars have pointed to the ways in which internationalism, a language of internationalism, worked in post-war Native activists' campaigns, and they drew inspiration from global decolonization movements in places like Asia and Africa, and from Cold War politics. One historian, Paul Rozier, in a book called Serving Their Country, mentioned Smart's campaign. He noted that she, quote, "shrewdly framed the issue in international terms. that her voice represented all Native people who objected to the imagined violence of these statues, especially in light of threats that federal policy was posing to Native communities in the 1950s. As I mentioned at the beginning of the paper, Smart joked about getting communists to blow up the rescue, but more seriously asserted that the monuments, and these are her words, are bad propaganda for America and would make excellent fodder for our enemies. In one letter, she wrote that removing the pieces would be in, quote, better keeping for the right kind of propaganda for Americanism. And in another letter, she argued that replacing the statues would demonstrate that the United States deserved to be, quote, in that enviable position of being a good example to the rest of the world. In yet another, she stated that rescue and discovery were, quote, not only a disgrace to the Indians, but something that is not good for our country, something that could be made much of and in the wrong way by our enemies if they were wont to make something of it. By framing her critiques in terms of international politics of the Cold War, and by using patriotic rhetoric, Smart infused her campaign with a certain amount of urgency that no doubt contributed to its success. But she's also, as I said at the beginning, part of a much deeper local history in Washington, D.C., one that centers around Native visitors and residents carving out their own spaces within the place of the Capitol. Indigenous people have always existed in the place now known as Washington, D.C., and Letta Meyer Smart was one among many generations of Native activists marking the landscape of the federal city, although really she was unmarking it, or marking it through erasure. The commemorative portrayals that populated the Capitol building in the 19th century were not only significant as a symbolic justification for policies of empire, but came to represent an emerging cultural mythology along the physical landscape of a national imagination. Here, Euro-American men claimed ownership of the city and of the nation and decorated it with the violent images of conquest, and yet they were never successful in commanding the city or the nation in a way that precluded the claims of others. When I read Letta Meyer Smart's letters, I heard Ely Parker's voice. As I mentioned in my introduction, in 1847, Parker visited Washington on behalf of the Tonawanda Seneca, and while there, he stood in the middle of the Capitol building rotunda and challenged the legacy of the moments depicted in sandstone. In his diary, he wrote about seeing those rotunda reliefs. I want to read the full entry for that day. Saturday, January 2nd, 1847. Went up to the Capitol building and listened to some nonsensical speeches made by some nobody member of Congress. That's how you know that he didn't plan on having anybody read this diary at any point in the future, right? Or maybe it also indicates that the more things change, the more they stay the same. In entering the rotunda of the Capitol, the object first meeting my vision is the representation of the landing of the Pilgrims in 1620 upon the barren shores of New England. They are represented as in a starving condition, and being about to land, an Indian has come forward offering them provision of his bounty. Who now, among the descendants of those illustrious pilgrims, would give one morsel to the dying and starving Indian? Turning around, we are met by another representation in plaster of Paris of William Penn and the Indians entering into an alliance. What virtue is there now in Indian treaties? Turning around a little more, we observe another representation, that of the young and beautiful Pocahontas saving Captain Smith at the risk of her own life. Who now, among the descendants of those whom she saved, would risk his or her life for an Indian? No sooner would they see him hanged like a Mexican traitor than risk one hair on their heads to save him. How ungrateful is man to his fellow man. Turning still more around, we find another and final representation, intended no doubt as the climax to the whole scene, that of Colonel Boone, the hero of Kentucky, in a mortal combat with an Indian. Both are struggling for life, but Boone has already killed one Indian and has trampled upon his mangled body. Such is the fate of the poor red man. In his contest with the whites, he is hopeless. Yet, he is not permitted to live in peace, nor are his last moments given to him by his insulting foe to make peace with God. Humbly we ask whether justice will always sleep. Will not the oppressed go free? In Letta Meyer Smart's words, I also hear Red Jacket. In 1828, Red Jacket, another Iroquois leader, visited the Capitol, and he made, quote, no inconsiderable sensation among the fashionables. He sauntered around the rotunda, stopping in front of the William Penn relief, and, quote, with a mixture of melancholy and indignation, observed to the interpreter in his native language that Father Penn had not left them enough land to shoot a rifle over. Similarly, the Ho-Chunk chief, Grizzly Bear, who, after looking at the first three reliefs and noting that Indians fed, saved, and gave land to Euro-Americans, turned to the Boone image and lamented simply, "There white man kill Indian. Ugh." These men engaged with the narrative of conquest and critiqued the hypocrisies of settler colonialism. Their very presence in the Capitol building and their overt challenges mark a dramatic departure from the imagined capital, whereby Indians are bewildered, violent, or simply absent. In Ledemeyer Smart's attempt to mark the landscape, she also echoed the men and women who visited and became part of Charles Bird King's famous Indian Gallery in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. King, a Washington artist whose studio was located nearby the War Department building, painted Indian delegates. Thomas McKinney, who was a longtime commissioner of Indian Affairs, used government funds to purchase nearly 150 portraits and arrayed them on the walls of the Indian office. Leaders from John Ross to Keokuk, Black Hawk to Red Jacket graced the gallery. For more than three decades, distinguished visitors, international and domestic, made their way to the Indian office to visit them. They were later moved to the Smithsonian, where they were ultimately lost in a fire, or at least most of them were. But it's possible to gauge the public response to the portraits and the overall message of the portrait gallery by examining the words of a few of its visitors. In an 1830 guidebook, author Jonathan Elliott encouraged his readers to stop by the Indian office. "It possesses much interest," he said, "perhaps more than any other in the government. The paintings," he wrote, "were not only fine specimens of art, but their close resemblance to the originals, they're perfect." The passage continued almost like a phrenological assessment. He described the clarity with which the Indians' heads had been portrayed, paying special attention to the central hemispheres because it's here that the, quote, "governing powers that lift man so far above the lower order of beings and distinguish his grade and characteristics of mind and intellect reside." Special care, he noted, had also been taken to preserve the costume of each tribe. The scientific tone of his description concluded by echoing the vanishing Indian trope of the 19th century. Imagining that Indians would cease to exist before too long, Eliot stated, "Our posterity will ask in vain what sort of looking being was the red man of this country." Seemingly unaware of the irony in his statement, he reminded readers, referring to the portraits, not to the Indian visitors themselves, that Indians must be, quote, "seen to be known." In her description of the gallery, British travelogue author Frances Trollope focused on the emotions that she imagined on the faces of these subjects. "The countenances," she said, "are full of expression, but the expression in most of them is extremely similar. I should say they have but two sorts of expression, that one is of a very noble and warlike daring, the other of a very gentle and naive simplicity." Interestingly, as knowledge of the gallery traveled, Native men and women began requesting to see the portraits too. For example, in 1828, a group of Ho-Chunk who visited the gallery from the area now known as Wisconsin became the subject of a lengthy correspondence between Commissioner of Indian Affairs McKinney and the Secretary of War, Peter Porter. The Ho-Chunk delighted in, quote, "seeing so many who were known to them, but complained we see no Winnebagoes here." Winnebago was the term at the time for Ho-Chunk people that was used by the Office of Indian Affairs. The government had for a time refused to pay for portraits, but the visitors, McKinney wrote, made almost daily visits. They, quote, "show an attachment so decided to the faces of those who have been painted and evince so much anxiety to have a similar respect paid to them. They offered to sell the stuff they brought with them to Washington, their clothing, their ornaments, their caps, their war clubs, in order to cover the cost of the portraits. Or barring that, they hoped that at least those items could be hung on the walls next to the portraits as a memorial." In the end, five of them sat for Charles Bird King to commemorate the visit. And Caleb Atwater, a government agent back at Prairie du Chien, later recalled that, quote, "nothing pleased these men so much as that their likenesses were in the Indian Gallery at the War Department. Seeing the paintings and being a part of that group meant something." The visitors looked for portraits of members of their community who had visited the city previously. It became a way to connect across time with people who had had similar experiences. But I think there's a couple of explanations for why having one's portrait added to that collection was so significant. First, the men were depicted wearing symbols of power and prestige that represented accomplishments and their social positions, things like feathers and ribbons and peace medals. So that was important. But secondly, and I think more importantly, it became a way to mark the landscape as indigenous and commemorate the experience of being in that place. I liken it to scrawling, "Red Jacket was here," 1828, on the wall, tagging it. Moving forward in time, and in an effort to move towards some sort of a conclusion, Ledemeyer smartly likely would have found much of interest in a 1978 interview conducted by Herman Viola, director of the National Anthropological Archive, with Henry Old Coyote, a member of the Crow Nation and an advisor to the Senate on legislation involving indigenous communities. In the course of this far-reaching conversation, Old Coyote talked about the reasons a visit to Washington, D.C. was meaningful to many Native people. "It's the nation's capital," he said, "but it's more like a shrine to the Indians." He continued, laying out an interesting juxtaposition. "It's also undesirable to the Indian, but there's a sacredness of the city, or a prestige to the city." Perhaps sensing the complexity in Old Coyote's response, Viola pressed further, asking him what was important symbolically about Washington. Old Coyote answered, "Indigenous people love their country, and this country is administered by the government in Washington. They feel that a certain reverence should be extended to that place." Thinking about Ledemeyer Smart's campaign to remove those statues, its historically rich roots, and the tactics that she used, framing her critiques in an international context and using patriotic rhetoric, helps to make sense of Old Coyote's words. And admittedly, this is something I've been trying to do since I read the transcripts of that interview at the Smithsonian National Anthropological Archives a couple of summers ago. The relationship between the capital and Native people is complex, but Washington, D.C., as I said at the beginning, was a local place before it became a federal city. Washington had to learn how to be national, as it did throughout the 19th century, and then how to be global, especially in the post-World War II period. The creation of a commemorative landscape, statues, paintings, reliefs, played a major role in this process. In the paintings and reliefs, in the architecture and the statues, much of which portrays the violence of conquest, as well as in the reactions against it, Native people have informed and shaped this process in profound ways. Although Henry Old Coyote could have the last word here, I'd prefer to end with a bit of a postscript. I've focused most of this talk on the Capitol building itself and some other federal spaces around Washington, but the Native histories of place pervade the city, and this last story I'll tell is a little further away from the National Mall. In 2010, Honors Director Jim Buss and I were in Washington, D.C. One day I went to the archives to do some research, and he went for a run. When I returned to our room later that evening, he asked if I knew anything about a bridge with four gigantic buffaloes. I'd only just begun the research for this project and knew nothing about such bridge. I went back to the archives the next day, and Jim went on another run, this time with his camera. When I returned the second evening, he showed me the pictures of the buffaloes as well as 56 Indian head reliefs that adorn the bridge, and you can see them there in the lower picture. "Native people are everywhere in this city," he said. I had to learn more. Georgetown, formed in 1751, decades before the District of Columbia or the city of Washington, and there you can see it on the left side there, to the left side of Rock Creek. For most of the 19th century, Georgetown remained a separate legal entity from the capital. But in 1871, it was merged with Washington. Rapid growth and residential sprawl over the next few decades encouraged city leaders to provide a connecting artery between North Georgetown and the Colorama neighborhood bordering DuPont Circle. There's one problem, and you can see it in this map: Rock Creek and the surrounding heights that separated the two. There was an initial plan that involved filling in the gorge with rocks and boulders and other junk, but the McMillan Commission, which was a Senate committee whose report guides the development of Washington, D.C. to this day, rejected it, opting instead to build a bridge. They selected Q Street as the location for this new bridge, which is interesting, because Q Street in Georgetown is 175 feet south of Q Street in DuPont Circle. So the bridge would have to be curved. Also, it came to a dead end at the historic Dumbarton Mansion, which would need to be lifted up and moved about 100 feet. They tapped a guy named Glenn Brown, who was a proponent and supporter of the Macmillan Commission and an architectural movement at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century called the City Beautiful Movement. He designed this bridge, which would become known as the Dumbarton Bridge, while famous animal sculptor Alexander Phimpster Proctor made the buffaloes. The bridge features several City Beautiful design elements. For example, its neoclassical arches, corbel arches, piers, and pillars are reminiscent of Roman aqueducts. More obviously, the style and scale were typical of the City Beautiful theory. After all, they could have built something that was simply functional and utilitarian, but City Beautiful was about form over function. The use of the buffalo and Indian head iconography, the most distinctive elements of the bridge, also connect its design to the City Beautiful movement. That movement got its start in the 1893 World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition in Chicago. And like the World's Fair itself, the bridge reflects a certain nostalgia for a vanishing frontier, a bygone past. In fact, in an interview, Glenn Brown noted that we, quote, naturally determined to give the carvings and the portions of the structure an American character. So in this formulation, it makes sense that the designers chose what seems to be a generic plains motif, right? Feathered headdresses, buffalo. As Jeannie O'Brien, a scholar of Native history, Cole Thrush, and your own honors director, Jim Buss, have argued elsewhere, these images are mobile and serve as free-floating stand-ins for a constellation of ideas that both express and excuse settler anxieties and guilt. The problem, of course, is that these images aren't free-floating and that histories aren't metaphors. There's another way to think about this bridge and its iconography, though, and it requires us to consider the layers of the city, as well as the deep indigenous history of Washington, D.C. The busts that sit below each of those pillars were actually modeled from a life mask of a man named Matowanadeka, or Kicking Bear, a Minneconju Lakota leader. Kicking Bear was significant because he was one of the three men who helped to bring the ghost dance from Utah to the plains. In the 1890s, Kicking Bear traveled to Washington, D.C. to advocate on behalf of the Lakota following the Wounded Knee Massacre. As an anti-colonial leader of the Ghost Dance movement and a critic of white settlement and an outspoken leader, Kicking Bear actually reminds me a lot of Letta Myers Smart. This is where it gets even more interesting. Also in the 1890s, there was an archaeologist named William Henry Holmes who conducted significant excavations around Washington, including at one point digging up Connecticut Avenue. One of the sites his team investigated thoroughly was called the Dumbarton Heights, an area that's just north of where that bridge sits today. Holmes and his team found an important stone quarry site where Chesapeake and Potomac peoples, for generations upon generations, excavated materials and made stone tools. And so here it is, all wrapped up in one site. A bridge built in the 19-teens using cutting-edge architectural technology and trendy design elements that are meant to memorialize and celebrate a generic and supposedly bygone American past. But the bust the designer used actually commemorates a Native leader who challenged American colonialism spiritually and militarily on the plains as well as politically in Washington, D.C. itself. And they built it on top of land that's been significant to indigenous inhabitants since time immemorial. Ancient, modern, vanishing, ever-present. Thank you. I think we have time for some questions and discussion if people want to stick around and talk for a couple of minutes.
So what really made you want to get into this field of study? What was the first time you realized, I got to do this? This was like my thing.
So I was an undergrad at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, And I had a chance to take classes with a guy whose name was Ed Danziger. And he's just retired this past year after teaching for 52 years, 104 semesters, which is pretty incredible. And he taught Native American history, he taught Ohio history. Before I met him, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I thought I would major in history. And both my parents are lawyers. They both majored in history. I just kind of, that was how much thought I sort of put into it. I was like, well, this is what people are supposed to do. Like, you go and study history and then study law, and that's what you do. But he was an amazing professor and actually showed a real interest in me. He thought that I was, good at writing or whatever. I don't know what it was. But it was his Native American history class that I found incredibly interesting. And then he took us to Walpole Island Indian Reserve in Canada. It's the southernmost Indian reservation in Canada, to meet members of the community there, to talk to people. And that's the moment that history stopped being just a set of interesting stories about stuff that happened to people a long time before I was born, to stuff that had a really important legacy that still exists today. And so meeting people at Walpole Island, this dialogue between the past and the present crystallized in a way that it had never happened for me before. I became inspired by that. I also became really interested in the native language of the people who lived there, Anishinaabemowin, and so I got a chance to go back and study language there. That was what it was. I hadn't had any particular interest in native history prior to that, but from that point on, I became really, really interested in it. And I want this work to kind of be as meaningful as I can, too. So part of this project, when I was in Washington 2 summers ago doing research, I found this great collection of documents that this guy, Herman Viola, the guy who had done that interview that I talked about, he kept track of every Indian delegation that he came across for 25 years in the historical documents. He would take out a sheet of paper, write down the name of the group, the name of the individuals, when they were in Washington, D.C., and then he went through the Smithsonian's photographic record and cross-referenced the individuals with the photographic negatives and put the little identifier numbers on those sheets of paper. The only way to access that information, and there's 8 folders, each one of them are 2 inches thick, just individual sheets of paper. So hundreds, dozens and hundreds of delegations over the course of 125 years. The only way to access that information is to go and sit in this little room in the museum support center at the Smithsonian and look at it. I want to digitize that so that Native communities who want to research their own delegations can use that material, and then actually link it to other collections in Oklahoma and Minnesota and Chicago and other places. So to try and take this research that I think is really important for Washington, D.C. and the city itself, but also make it useful for the communities who, whose information has traveled to Washington, kind of reverse that flow and make that information flow back out of Washington to the tribal communities themselves.
Mm-hmm. What is your favorite Indian tribe that you've studied?
So it's interesting. I thought that because of the connections that I made at Walpole Island which is not too far across the border from Detroit, I thought that I would spend my time in graduate school studying Great Lakes Native history, and I did spend, 3 years studying the languages. So Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Odawa peoples. But then when it came time to actually do my dissertation research, I ended up working with and thinking about more Eastern peoples from New York and Ontario, Haudenosaunee Iroquois people, Seneca primarily. So I don't know if that's really a favorite or anything, but that was kind of what I thought I was going to do. This story is a really, the Washington, D.C. story is so interesting because it's a multi-tribal story. There are all these really important and rich, unique histories for different tribal communities across the nation. But one thing that all tribal communities have in common is a relationship with Washington, D.C. That's something that actually unites all of these disparate, unique histories. In the documents that I've been reading, there are all these fascinating moments where in the 1800s, delegations were coming in, and especially when Congress was in session, because they were coming in to lobby Congress, delegations, 6 different delegations at a time of 20 people all staying in the same hotel. So you would have a hotel in Washington that's full, literally, of Osage, Cherokee, Choctaw, Ojibwe, and Ho-Chunk people from different parts of the country. Imagine what they were talking about. Like, what were they talking about? What were they doing? Imagine what that experience must have been like. Were they sharing stories about working with different government agents? Were they sharing, or were they not talking about that at all? Were they talking about things they were doing in Washington, D.C.? We can get at that a little bit. But that's what's so interesting to me about the Washington, D.C. story.
Mm-hmm. So what are your future plans? Like, in terms of a long-term goal regarding your field study?
That's a really good question. So there's a lot of stuff that I'm working on. So one thing that Professor Buss didn't say in his introduction is that this co-edited volume that's coming out is co-edited with Professor Buss. That's coming out soon. I hope that I can continue to do this kind of work and work with really great students. I've been lucky up to this point in my career to have had some great students. And really working with those students inspires me to want to do more of this. It sort of really keeps me excited about it, and being able to tell these stories to classrooms full of students and work with them in their own research is something that inspires me a whole lot. And so I've been really lucky to have some great students.
Mm-hmm. Having done all of this research and learned about a lot of the stories that particularly talk about Native American subjugation and their reactions to that, have you felt any sort of compulsion to begin, a new step in a political sphere to take action in that sort of way? Have you felt sort of compelled to do that?
Yeah, so we talk a lot about what it means to become an ally, what it means to become an ally to indigenous communities and indigenous people, and work in that capacity. I think that that's a really important role, and one that somebody who comes from settler ancestry. I mean, my family immigrated here in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century. So I identify as a person of settler ancestry. It's a learning process, and it's about listening first, not acting in a position of sort of the white academic expert, and trying to be helpful and useful in whatever ways I can be. One of the things that I've been most proud of, that I've been able to do, given the opportunities that I've had, is to invite people, after being invited to Walpole Island, invite people from Walpole Island to come to Michigan State University when I was there and talk to students and teach students about issues that are important to them, and continue to build those relationships and build those bridges. I think that that's really important. For me, it's an ongoing process, I think. Being an ally in this way is difficult work, and one has to be willing to, be really humble. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned how other historians interpreted the one statue of the Native American woman looking up at Christopher Columbus, with his spear. How do you interpret the Native American woman's reaction to Christopher?
So I think that a lot of the criticism in terms of the structures of the statues are kind of right on, right? If you look at sort of the massive pose of Columbus, right? She does, the contours of her body, they do look like she's startled, moving. Certainly I wouldn't interpret that as awe necessarily. That was one of the things that Ledemeyer Smart noted. I think worry or concern would be similar there. But there is a contrast between the solid lines of Columbus versus the sort of twistedness of her body. So that's what I see when I look at it. And then of course it is, it is telling that her only bit of clothing is also falling off. And that was one of the criticisms actually of the George Washington statue. Was that it was considered vulgar to to portray the father of the nation without a shirt on, right? Clearly all of those Victorian women there don't find it particularly vulgar. They're kind of gawking. But.
I'd like to thank our speaker once again.
Thank you all.
You have been listening to the Bellevance Honors Program Lecture Series. In the spirit and in the words of 19th century theologian and philosopher Cardinal John Henry Newman, we hope that this series advances the idea of a university as a place where inquiry is pushed forward.
This program was recorded, edited, and produced by students and faculty at Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Produced by Dr. James Buss and Susanna Mallow. Lecture recorded and edited by Susanna Mallow. Theme song written and performed by Emmanuel Flores. Theme song recorded by Victoria Lazinski, Shayla McLaurin, and Juan Soto Bound.
From the campus of Salisbury University, you are listening to Delmarva Public Radio. Find us on the web at delmarvapublicradio.net or the TuneIn Radio app on your